The convoy sergeants carried the bundles of prison cases, torn folders tied somehow with twine or ersatz cotton string made of paper, into a separate wooden building that housed the prison offices, and tossed them onto shelves, on tables, under chairs, and simply on the floor in the aisle, just as their subject prisoners lay in the cells. They became untied and got scattered and mixed up. One room, a second, and a third got filled with those mixed-up cases. Secretaries from the prison office, well-fed, lazy, free women in bright-coloured dresses, sweated in the heat, fanned themselves and flirted with prison and convoy officers. None of them wanted to or had the strength to pick a way through that chaos, and yet the trainloads had to be dispatched in the red trains several times a week, and every day 100 people had to be sent out on trucks to nearby camps. The case of every Zek had to be sent with him. So just who was going to work on all that long, drawn-out mess? Who was there to sort out the cases and select the prisoners for the transports? It was entrusted to several work assignment supervisors from among the transit prison trustees, who were either bitches or half-breeds. Half-breeds, or mulattoes, polutsvetnia in Russian, were prisoners who had grown spiritually close to the thieves and tried to imitate them, but who had nonetheless not been accepted by the thieves' law. They moved freely through the prison corridors, entered the prison office, and were the ones who decided whether your case would be put in a bad prisoner transport, or whether they would really exert themselves, search long and hard, and put it in a good one. The newcomers were not mistaken in thinking that there were whole camps which were death camps, and they were right about that, but their idea that there were some that were good was simply a delusion. There were no good camps, but only certain easier duties within them, and they could only be sorted out on the spot. The fact that the prisoner's whole future depended on such another prisoner, with whom one ought perhaps to find the chance to talk, even if via the bath attendant, and whose hand one ought perhaps to grease, even if via the storage room keeper, was worse than if his fortunes had simply been determined blindly by a roll of the dice. This invisible and unrealized opportunity to go south to Nalchik instead of north to Norilsk, in return for a leather jacket, to go to Serebryani Bor outside Moscow instead of Taishet in Siberia for a couple of pounds of fat bacon, and perhaps to lose both the leather jacket and the fat bacon for nothing at all, only aggravated and fatigued, tired souls. Maybe someone did manage to arrange it, maybe someone got himself fixed up that way, but most blessed of all were those who had nothing to give or who spared themselves all that anxiety. Submissiveness to fate, the total abdication of your own will in the shaping of your life, the recognition that it was impossible to guess the best and the worst ahead of time, but that it was easy to take a step you would reproach yourself for, all this freed the prisoner from any bondage, made him calmer, and even ennobled him. And thus it was that the prisoners lay in rows in the cells, and their fates lay in undisturbed piles in the rooms of the prison office. And the assignment supervisors took the files from the particular corner where it was easiest to get at them. And some Zeks had to spend 2 or 3 months gasping in this accursed presnia, while others would whiz through it with the speed of a shooting star. As a result of all that congestion, haste, and disorder with the cases, sometimes sentences got switched at Presnia, and at other transit prisons as well. This didn't affect the 58s, because their prison terms, in Maxim Gorky's phrase, were terms with a capital letter, were intended to be long, and even when they seemed to be nearing their end, they just never got there anyway. But it made sense for big thieves and murderers to switch with some stupid non-political offender. And so they or their accomplices would inch up to such an individual and question him with interest and concern. And he, not knowing that a short-termer at a transit prison isn't supposed to disclose anything about himself, would innocently tell them that his name was, for example, Vasily Parvenich Yefrashkin, that he was born in 1913, that he lived in Semidubye, and had been born there, and his term was 1 year. Article 109, negligence. And then Yevrashkin was asleep, or maybe not even asleep, but there was such a racket in the cell, and there was such a crowd at the swill trough in the door, that he couldn't make his way there and listen, while on the other side of it in the corridor they were rapidly muttering a list of names for a prisoner transport. Some of the names were shouted from the door into the cell, but not Yevreshkin's, because hardly had the name been read out in the corridor than an Urka, a thief, had obsequiously, and they can be obsequious when it's necessary, shoved up his snout and answered quickly and quietly, "Vasily Parvenich, born 1913, village of Semidubye, 109, 1 year," and ran off to get his things. The real Yevrashkin yawned, lay back on his bunk, and patiently waited to be called the next day, and the next week, and the next month. And then he made so bold as to bother the prison superintendent. Why hadn't he been taken in a prisoner transport? And every day in all the cells they kept calling out the name of some Zviaga. And when a month later, or a half year later, they got around to combing through all the cases by calling the roll, what they had left was just one file, belonging to Zviaga, a multiple offender sentenced for a double murder and robbing a store, 10 years, and one shy prisoner who was trying to tell everybody that he was Yevrashkin, although you couldn't make anything out from the photo. And so he damn well was Zviaga, and he had to be tucked away in a penalty camp, Ivdelag, because otherwise it would have been necessary to confess that the transit prison had made a mistake. And as for that other Yevrashkin who had been sent off on a prisoner transport, you wouldn't even be able to find where he had gone, because none of the lists were left. And anyway, he had only had a 1 year term and had been sent to do farm work without being under guard, and got 3 days off his sentence for every day he worked, or else he had simply run away and was long since home, or, more likely, was already imprisoned again on a new sentence. There were also eccentrics who sold their short terms for a kilo or two of fat bacon. They figured that in any case the authorities would check up and establish their correct identities, and sometimes they did. And, as P. Yakubovich writes in reference to the so-called cadgers, the sale of prison terms took place in the last century too. It is an ancient prison trick. During the years when the prisoners' cases didn't carry any indication of their final destination, the transit prisons turned into slave markets. The most desired guests at the transit prisons were the buyers. This word was heard more and more often in the corridors and cells and was used without any shadow of irony. Just as it became intolerable everywhere in industry simply to sit and wait until things were sent from the centre on the basis of allocations, and it was more satisfactory to send one's own pushers and pullers to get things done. The same thing happened in Gulag. The natives on the islands kept dying off. And even though they cost not one ruble, a count was kept of them, and one had to worry about getting more of them for oneself so there wouldn't be any failure in fulfilling the plan. The buyers had to be sharp, have good eyes, and look carefully to see what they were taking so that last leggers and invalids didn't get shoved off on them. The buyers who picked a transport on the basis of case files were poor buyers. The conscientious merchants demanded that the merchandise be displayed alive and bare-skinned for them to inspect. And that was just what they used to say, without smiling, merchandise. "Well, what merchandise have you brought?" asked a buyer at the Butyrki station, observing and inspecting the female attributes of 17-year-old Ira Kalina. Human nature, if it changes at all, changes not much faster than the geological face of the earth, and the very same sensations of curiosity, relish, and sizing up which slave traders felt at the slave girl markets 25 centuries ago, of course possessed the Gulag bigwigs in the Usman prison in 1947. When they, a couple of dozen men in MVD uniform, sat at several desks covered with sheets. This was for their self-importance, since it would have seemed awkward otherwise. And all the women prisoners were made to undress in the box next door, and to walk in front of them barefooted and bare-skinned, turn around, stop, and answer questions. "Drop your hands," they ordered those who had adopted the defensive pose of classic sculpture. After all, these officers were very seriously selecting bedmates for themselves and their colleagues. And so it was that for the new prisoner, various manifestations foreshadowed the camp battle of the morrow and cast their pall over the innocent spiritual joys of the transit prison. For just 2 nights, they put a special assignment prisoner in our cell in Krasnaya Preznia. And he was next to me in the bunk. He travelled about with special assignment orders, which meant that an invoice had been filled out in central administration indicating that he was a construction technician and could be used only in that capacity in his new location, and this went with him from camp to camp. The special assignment prisoner was travelling in the common Storypin cars and was kept in the common cells of the transit prisons, but he wasn't nervous. He was protected by his personal document, and he wouldn't be driven out to fell timber. A cruel and determined expression was the principal trait of this camp veteran's face. He had already served out the greater part of his term, and I did not yet realize that this exact expression would in time etch itself on all our faces, because a cruel and determined expression is the national hallmark of the Gulag Islanders. People with soft, conciliatory expressions die out quickly on the islands. He observed our naive floundering with an ironic smile, just as people look at 2-week-old puppies. What should we expect in camp? Taking pity on us, he taught us. From your very first step in camp, everyone will try to deceive and plunder you. Trust no one but yourself. Look around quickly. Someone may be sneaking up on you to bite you. 8 years ago, I arrived at Kargopolag just as innocent and just as naive as you are now. They unloaded us from 2 trains, and the convoy prepared to lead us the 6 miles to the camp through the deep, crumbly snow. 3 sleds came up beside us. Some hefty chap, whom the convoy didn't interfere with, came over to us and said, "Brothers, put your things on the sleds, and we will carry them there for you." We remembered reading in books that prisoners' belongings were carried on carts, and we thought, it isn't going to be all that inhuman in camp. They're concerned about us. And we loaded our things on the sleds. They left, and we never saw them again, not even an empty wrapper.
But how can that happen? Isn't there any law there?
Don't ask idiotic questions. There is a law there, the law of the tiger, of the jungle. But as for justice, there never has been any in Gulag, and there never will be. That Kargopol incident was simply a symbol of Gulag, and you have to get used to something else, too. In camp, no one ever does anything for nothing. No one ever does anything out of the generosity of his heart. You have to pay for everything. If someone proposes something to you that is unselfish, disinterested, you can be sure it's a dirty trick, a provocation. The main thing is, avoid general assignment work. Avoid it from the day you arrive. If you land in general assignment work that first day, then you are lost, and this time for keeps.
General assignment work?
General assignment work. That is the main and basic work performed in any given camp. 80% of the prisoners work at it, and they all die off. All. And then they bring new ones in to take their places, and they again are sent to general assignment work. Doing this work, you expend the last of your strength, and you're always hungry, and always wet, and shoeless, and you are given short rations and short everything else, and put in the worst barracks, and they won't give you any treatment when you're ill. The only ones who survive in camps are those who try at any price not to be put on general assignment work, from the first day.
At any price?
At any price.
At Krasnaya Preznia, I assimilated and accepted this altogether unexaggerated advice of the cruel special assignment prisoner, forgetting only to ask him one thing. How do you measure that price? How high do you go?
Chapter 3. The Slave Caravans. It was painful to travel in a Stolypin, unbearable in a Black Maria, and the transit prison would soon wear you down. And it might just be better to skip the whole lot and go straight to camp in the red cattle cars. As always, the interests of the state and the interests of the individual coincided here. It was also to the state's advantage to dispatch sentenced prisoners straight to the camps by direct routing and thus avoid overloading the city trunk line railroads, automotive transport, and transit camp personnel. They had long since grasped this fact in Gulag, and it had been taken to heart. Witness the caravans of red cows, red cattle cars, the caravans of barges, and where there were no rails and no water, the caravans on foot. After all, prisoners could not be allowed to exploit the labor of horses and camels. The red trains were always a help when the courts in some particular place were working swiftly, or the transit facilities were overcrowded. It was possible in this way to dispatch a large number of prisoners in one batch. That is how the millions of peasants were transported in 1929 to 1931. That is how they exiled Leningrad from Leningrad. That is how they populated the Kolyma in the 30s. Every day, Moscow, the capital of our country, belched out one such train to Sovetskaya Gavan, to Vanino Port. And each provincial capital also sent off red trainloads, but not on a daily schedule. That is how they removed the Volga German Republic to Kazakhstan in 1941. And later, all the rest of the exiled nations were sent off in the same way. In 1945, Russia's prodigal sons and daughters were sent from Germany, from Czechoslovakia, from Austria, and simply from western border areas, whoever had gotten there on his own, in such trains as these. In 1949, that is how they collected the 58s in special camps. The Stolypins follow routine railroad schedules, and the red trains travel on imposing waybills signed by important Gulag generals. The Stolypins cannot go to an empty site, to nowhere. Their destination must always be a station, even if it's in some nasty little two-bit town with some preliminary detention cells in an attic. But the red trains can go into emptiness, and wherever one does go, there immediately rises right next to it, out of the sea of the steppe, or the Sea of the Taiga, a new island of the archipelago. Not every red cattle car is ready as is to transport prisoners. First it has to be prepared, but not in the sense some of our readers might expect, that the coal or lime it carried before it was assigned to carry people has to be swept out and the car cleaned. That isn't always done. Nor in the sense that it needs to be caulked and have a stove installed if it is winter. When the section of the railroad from Knyaz Pogost to Ropcha was being built, and wasn't yet part of the general railroad network, they immediately began to transport prisoners on it, in freight cars without either stoves or bunks. In winter, the Zeks lay on the icy, snowy floor, and weren't even given any hot food, because the train could make it all the way through this section in less than a day. Whoever can, in imagination, lie there like them and survive those 18 to 20 hours, shall indeed survive. Here is what was involved in preparing a red cattle car for prisoners. The floors, walls, and ceilings had to be tested for strength and checked for holes or faults. Their small windows had to be barred. A hole had to be cut in the floor to serve as a drain, and specially protected by sheet iron firmly nailed down all around it. The necessary number of platforms on which convoy guards would stand with machine guns had to be evenly distributed throughout the train, and if there were too few, more had to be built. Access to the roofs of the cars had to be provided. Sites for searchlights had to be selected and supplied with uninterrupted electric power. Long-handled wooden mallets had to be procured. A passenger car had to be hooked on for the staff, and if there wasn't one, then instead heated freight cars had to be prepared for the chief of convoy, the security officer, and the convoy. Kitchens had to be built for the convoy and for the prisoners. And only after all this had been done was it all right to walk along the cattle cars and chalk on the sides special equipment or perishable goods. In her chapter, The Seventh Car, Yevgenia Ginsburg described the transport of red cars very vividly, and her description largely obviates the necessity of presenting details here. The preparation of the train has been completed, and ahead lies the complicated combat operation of loading the prisoners into the cars. At this point, there are two important and obligatory objectives: to conceal the loading from ordinary citizens, to terrorize the prisoners.
To conceal the loading from the local population was necessary because approximately 1,000 people were being loaded on the train simultaneously, at least 25 cars, and this wasn't your little group from a stolypin that could be led right past the townspeople. Everyone knew, of course, that arrests were being made every day and every hour, but no one was to be horrified by the sight of large numbers of them together. In Orel, in 1938, you could hardly hide the fact that there was no home in the city where there hadn't been arrests, and weeping women in their peasant carts blocked the square in front of the Orel prison, just as in Surikov's painting, The Execution of the Streltsy. Oh, who one day will paint this latter-day tragedy for us? But no one will. It's not fashionable. Not fashionable. But you don't need to show our Soviet people an entire trainload of them collected in one day. And in Orel that year there were. And young people mustn't see it either, for young people are our future. Therefore it was done only at night. And every night, too, each and every night, and that was the way it went for several months. The black line of prisoners to be transported was driven from the prison to the station on foot. Meanwhile, the Black Mariahs were busy making new arrests. True, the women realized, the women somehow found out, and at night they came to the station from all over the city and kept watch over the trains on the siding. They ran along the cars, tripping over the ties and rails, and shouting at every car, "Is so-and-so in there? Is so-and-so in there?" And they ran on to the next one, and others ran up to this one. "Is so-and-so in there?" And suddenly an answer would come from the sealed car. "I'm in here! I'm here!" Or else, "Keep looking for him! He's in another car!" Or else, "Women, listen! My wife is somewhere out there near the station. Run and tell her!" These scenes, unworthy of our contemporary world, testify only to the then inept organization of train embarkations. The mistakes were noted, and after a certain night the trains were surrounded in depth by cordons of snarling and barking police dogs. And in Moscow, the loading into red cattle cars from the old Sretenka transit prison, which prisoners no longer remember, or from Krasnaya Preznya, took place only at night. That was the rule. However, although the convoy had no use for the superfluous light of the sun by day, on the other hand, they made use of suns by night, the searchlights. They were more efficient, since they could be concentrated on the necessary area, where the prisoners were seated on the earth in a frightened pack awaiting the command, "Next unit of five, stand up, to the car, on the run." Only on the run, so as not to have time to look around, to think things over, to run as though chased by the dogs, afraid of nothing so much as falling down. On that uneven path, up the loading ramp, scrambling. And clear, hostile searchlight beams not only provided light, but were an important theatrical element in terrorizing the prisoners, along with yells, threats, gunstock blows on those who fell behind, and the order, "Sit down!" And sometimes, as in the station square of that same Orel, "Down on your knees!" And like some new breed of believers at prayer, the whole thousand would get down on their knees. Along with that running to the car, quite unnecessary except for intimidation, for which it was very important. Along with the enraged barking of the dogs, along with the leveled gun barrels, rifles or automatic pistols, depending on the decade. And the main thing was to undermine, to crush the prisoner's willpower so he wouldn't think of trying to escape, so that for a long time he wouldn't notice his new advantage, the fact that he had exchanged a stone-walled prison for a railroad car with thin plank walls. But in order to load 1,000 prisoners into railroad cars at night so precisely, the prison had to start jerking them out of their cells and processing them for transport the morning before, and the convoy had to spend the entire day on a long, drawn-out and strict procedure of checking them in while still in prison, and then holding those who'd been checked in for long hours, not, of course, in the cells by now, but in the courtyard, on the ground, so as not to mix them up with the prisoners still belonging in the prison. Thus, for the prisoner, the loading at night was only a relief after a whole day of torment.
Besides the ordinary counts, verifications, hair clipping, clothing roasting, and baths, the core of the preparation for the prisoner transport was general frisking. This search was carried out not by the prison, but by the convoy receiving the prisoners. The convoy was expected, in accordance with the directives regarding the Red Transports, and in accordance with their own operational requirements, to carry out this search so that the prisoners would not be left in possession of anything that might help them to escape, to take away everything that could saw or cut, all powders, tooth powder, sugar, salt, tobacco, tea, so that they could not be used to blind the convoy. All string, cord, twine, belts and straps, because they could all be used in escaping, and that meant all kinds of straps, and so they cut off the straps which held up the artificial limb of a one-legged man, and the cripple had to carry his artificial leg on his shoulder and hop with the help of those on either side of him. The rest of the things, all valuables and suitcases too, were, according to instructions, supposed to be checked and carried in a special baggage car and returned to their owners at the end of the journey. Yet the power of the Moscow directive was weak and might be ignored by the Vologda or the Kuibyshev convoy, while the power of the convoy over the prisoners was very corporeal, very real. And this fact was crucial to the third objective of the loading operation. In simple justice, to take all the good things they possess from enemies of the people for the use of its sons. Sit down. On your knees. Strip. In these statutory orders of the convoy lay the basic power one could not argue with. After all, a naked person loses his self-assurance. He cannot straighten up proudly and speak as an equal to people who are still clothed. A search begins. Kuibyshev, summer of 1949. Naked prisoners approach, carrying their possessions and the clothes they've taken off. A mass of armed soldiers surrounds them. It doesn't look as though they were going to be led to a prisoner transport, but as though they are going to be shot immediately or put to death in a gas chamber. And in that mood, a human being ceases to concern himself with his possessions. The convoy does everything with intentional brusqueness, rudely, sharply, not speaking one word in an ordinary human voice. After all, the purpose is to terrify and dishearten. Suitcases are shaken apart, and things fall all over the floor, and are then stacked up in separate piles. Cigarette cases, billfolds, and other pitiful valuables are all taken away and thrown without any identifying marks into a barrel that is standing nearby. And for some reason, the fact that this particular receptacle isn't a safe or a trunk or a box, but a barrel, particularly depresses the naked prisoners there, and it seems so terribly futile to protest. The naked prisoner has all he can do simply to snatch up his well-searched rags from the floor and knot them together or tie them up in a blanket. Felt boots, you can check them, throw them over there, sign for them on the list. You aren't the one who gets the receipt, but you are the one who signs for having surrendered them, certifying that you threw them onto the pile. And when, at dusk, the last truck leaves the prison yard with the prisoners, they see the convoy guards rushing to grab the best leather suitcases from the pile and select the best cigarette cases from the barrel. And after them, the jailers scurry for their booty too, and last of all, the transit prison trustees. That is what it cost to spend one day to get to the cattle car. And now, the prisoners have clambered with a relief up onto the splintered planks of the bunks. But what kind of relief is this? What kind of heated cattle car is this? Once again, they are squeezed in a nutcracker between cold and starvation, between the thieves and the convoy. If there are thieves in a cattle car, and they are, of course, not kept separate in the red trains either, they take the best places, as is traditional, on the upper bunks by the window. That's in summer. So we can guess where their places are in winter, next to the stove, of course, in a tight ring around the stove. As the former thief Minayev recalls,
In 1949, during a severe cold wave, they were issued only 3 pails of coal for their car for the entire journey from Voronezh to Cutlass, lasting several days. And in this crisis, the thieves not only occupied the places around the stove, and not only took all the suckers' warm things away from them and put them on, but didn't even hesitate to take their foot cloths out of their shoes and wind them around their own feet. You today, me tomorrow. It was somewhat worse with food. The thieves took charge of the whole ration for the car, and then kept the best for themselves, along with whatever else they needed. Loschilin recalls a 3-day prisoner transport from Moscow to Perebory in 1937. They didn't cook anything hot on the train for such a short journey, and handed out only dry rations. The thieves took the best for themselves, but gave the others permission to divide up the bread and the herring, and that meant they weren't hungry. When the ration was hot and the thieves were in charge of distributing it, they divided up the gruel among themselves, a 3-week transport from Kishinev to Pechora in 1945. With all this, the thieves didn't scruple to engage also in plain and simple robbery en route. They noticed an Estonian's gold teeth, and they pushed him down and knocked out the teeth with a poker. The Zeks considered the hot food the real advantage of the red trains. At remote stations, again where people couldn't see them, the train stopped, and gruel and porridge were doled out to the cars. But they even managed to give out the hot food in such a way that things went wrong. They might, as on that same Kishinev train, pour out the gruel in the same pails in which they issued coal, there being nothing to wash them out with. Because drinking water was also rationed on the train and was even in shorter supply than gruel. And so you gulped down the gruel, your teeth gritting on pieces of coal. Or they brought the gruel and the hot cereal to the car and didn't issue enough bowls, 25 instead of 40, and promptly ordered, "Come on, come on, faster, faster, we have other cars to feed to, not just you." How then could you eat? How could you divide it up? You couldn't dish it out equitably on the basis of bowls, and that meant you had to estimate each portion so as not to give out too much. And those to be served first would shout, "Stir it, stir it!" And the last kept silent. There would be more on the bottom. The first were eating, and the last waiting. They would have liked the others to eat faster because they were hungry, and meanwhile the gruel would be getting cold in the barrel, and they were also being hurried from outside. "Well, have you finished? Come on now, get a move on." And then they served the second contingent, not more, and not less, and not thicker, and not thinner than the first. And then came estimating the leftovers correctly and pouring them out 2 portions to a bowl. And all this time, 40 people don't so much eat as watch the sharing out and suffer. They don't heat the car, they don't protect the other prisoners from the thieves, they don't give you enough to drink, and they don't give you enough to eat. But on the other hand, they don't let you sleep either. During the day, the convoy can see the whole train very clearly and the tracks behind them, and can be sure that no one has jumped out the side or slipped down on the rails. But at night, vigilance possesses them. With long-handled wooden mallets, the standard gulag equipment, they knock resoundingly on every board of the car at every stop. Maybe someone has soared through it. And at certain stops, the door of the car is thrown open. The light of the lantern or the beam of the searchlight. "Check up!" And this means, get on your feet and be ready to go where they tell you. Everyone run to the left or to the right. The convoy guards jump inside with their mallets. Others have ranged themselves in a semicircle outside with automatic pistols. And they point. "To the left!" That means that those on the left are in place and those on the right must get over there on the jump like fleas hopping over each other and landing where they can. And whoever isn't nimble, whoever gets caught daydreaming gets whacked on the ribs and back with the mallets to give him more energy. And by this time the convoy jackboots are already trampling your pauper's palate, and all your lousy duds are being thrown in every direction, and everywhere there are lights and hammering. Have you soared through any place? No. Then the convoy guards stand in the middle and begin to shift you from left to right, counting, first, second, third.
It would be quite enough to count simply with a wave of the finger, but if that were done, it wouldn't be terrifying, and so it is more vivid, less subject to error, more energetic and faster. To beat out that count with the same mallet on your ribs, shoulders, heads, wherever it happens to land. They have counted up to 40, so now they will go about their tossing, lighting up, and hammering at the other end of the car. It's all over finally, and the car is locked up. You can go back to sleep till the next stop. And one can't really say that the anxiety of the convoy guard is entirely unfounded, because those who know how can escape from the red cattle cars. For instance, they knock on a board to test it and find it has been partially sawed through, or suddenly in the morning when the gruel is being distributed, they see that there are several shaved faces among the unshaven ones, and they surround the car with their automatic pistols. "Hand over your knives!" And this is really just petty bravado on the part of the thieves and their allies. They got tired of being unshaven, and now they're going to have to turn in their razor. The red train differs from other long-distance trains in that those who have embarked on it do not know whether or not they will disembark. When they unloaded a trainload from the Leningrad prisons, 1942, in Solikamsk, the entire embankment was covered with corpses, and only a few got there alive. In the winters of 1944 to 1945 and 1945 to 1946, in the village of Zheleznorodchny, Kainaj Pogost, as in all the main rail junctions in the north, the prisoner trains from liberated territories, the Baltic states, Poland, Germany, arrived with one or two carloads of corpses tacked on behind. That meant that en route they had carefully taken the corpses out of the cars that contained the living passengers and put them in the dead cars, but not always. There were many occasions when they found out who was still alive and who was dead, only when they opened up the car after arriving at the Sukhobezvodnaya Unschlag station. Those who didn't come out were dead. It was terrifying and deadly to travel this way in winter because the convoy, with all its bother about security, wasn't able to haul coal for 25 stoves. But it wasn't so cushy to travel this way in hot weather either. Two of the four tiny windows were tightly sealed, and the car roof would overheat, and the convoy wasn't about to exert itself in hauling water for 1,000 prisoners. After all, they couldn't even manage to give just one Stolypin car enough to drink. The prisoners considered April and September the best months for transports, but even the best of seasons was too short if the train was en route for 3 months. Leningrad to Vladivostok in 1935. And if such a long trip is in prospect, then arrangements have been made for both political indoctrination of the convoy soldiers and spiritual care of the imprisoned souls. In a separate railroad car attached to such a train travels a godfather, a security officer. He has made his preparations for the prisoner transport train back in prison, and prisoners are assigned to cars not simply at random, but according to lists he has validated. He is the one who appoints the monitor in each car and who has instructed and assigned a stool pigeon to each. At long stops, he finds some pretext for summoning both from the car and asks what the people are talking about in there. And any such security chief would be ashamed to finish the journey without signed and sealed results. And so, right there en route, he puts someone under interrogation, and lo and behold, by the time they reach their destination, the prisoner has been handed a new prison term. No, damn that red cattle car train, too, even though it did carry the prisoners straight to their destination without changing trains. Anyone who has ever been in one will never forget it. Just as well get to camp sooner. Just as well arrive sooner. A human being is all hope and impatience, as if the security officer in camp will be any more humane or the stoolies any less unscrupulous. It's just the other way around, as if they won't force us to the ground with those same threats and those same police dogs when we arrive. Sit down! As if there will be less snow on the ground in camp than what has sifted through into the cattle cars. As if it means that we've already gotten to where we're going when they begin to unload us and won't be carried farther in open flat cars on a narrow gauge track. And how can they carry us in open flat cars? How can we be kept under guard? That's a problem for the convoy. And here is how they do it. They order us to lie down, all huddled together, and they cover us with one big tarpaulin, like the sailors in the motion picture Potemkin before they're to be executed. And say thank you for the tarpaulin, too. In the north, in October, Olenyev and his comrades had the luck to have to sit in open flat cars all day long. They had already embarked, but no locomotive had come. First it rained, then it froze, and the Zek's rags froze on them. The tiny train will jerk and toss as it moves, and the sides of the flat car will begin to crack and break, and the bouncing will hurl someone off the car and under the wheels. And here is a riddle. If one is travelling 60 miles from Dudinka through Arctic frost in open flat cars on the narrow gauge track, then where are the thieves going to be? Answer, in the middle of each flat car, so the livestock around them will keep them warm and keep them from falling under the train themselves. Right answer. Question, what will the Zeks see at the end of this narrow gauge track, 1939? Will there be any buildings there? No, not a one. Any dugouts? Yes, but already occupied, not for them. And does that mean that the first thing they do will be to dig themselves dugouts? No, because how can they dig in the Arctic winter? Instead, they will be sent out to mine metal. And where will they live? What? Live? Oh, yes, live. They will live in tents. But will there always be a narrow-gauge track? No, of course not. The train arrived, Yertsovo Station, February 1938. The railroad cars were opened up at night. Bonfires were lit alongside the train, and disembarkation took place by their light. Then a count-off, forming up, and a count-off again. The temperature was 32 degrees below zero centigrade. The prisoners' transport train had come from the Donbass, and all the prisoners had been arrested back in the summer, and were wearing low shoes, Oxfords, even sandals. They tried to warm themselves at the fires, but the guards chased them away. That's not what the fires were there for. They were there to give light. Fingers grew numb almost instantly. The snow filled the thin shoes and didn't even melt. There was no mercy, and the order was given, "Fall in! Form up! One step to the right or left, and we'll fire without warning! Forward march!" The dogs on their chains howled at their favourite command, at the excitement of the moment. The convoy guards marched ahead in their sheepskin coats, and the doomed prisoners in their summer clothes marched through deep snow on a totally untravelled road, somewhere into the dark taiga, nary a light ahead. The northern lights gleamed. For them it was their first, and probably their last view of them. The fir trees crackled in the frost. The ill-shod prisoners paced and trod down the snow, their feet and legs growing numb from the cold. Or, as another example, here is a January, 1945, arrival at Pechora. "Our armies have captured Warsaw. Our armies have cut off East Prussia." An empty snowy field. The prisoners were tossed out of the cars, made to sit down in the snow by sixes, painstakingly counted off, miscounted, and counted again. They were ordered to stand up, and then were harried through a snowy virgin waste for 4 miles. This prisoner transport was also from the south, from Moldavia, and everyone was wearing leather shoes. The police dogs were right on their heels, and the dogs pushed the Zeks in the last row with their paws on their backs, breathing on the backs of their heads. 2 priests were in that row, old grey-haired Father Fyodor Floria and young Father Viktor Shipovalnikov, who was helping to hold him up. What a use for police dogs! No, what self-restraint it showed on the dogs' part! After all, they wanted to bite so badly. Finally they arrived. There was a camp reception bath. They had to undress in one cabin, run across the yard naked, and wash in another. But all this was bearable now. The worst was over. They had arrived. Twilight fell, and all of a sudden it was learned that there was no room for them. The camp wasn't ready to receive the prisoner transport, and after the bath the prisoners were again formed up, counted, surrounded by dogs, and were marched back to their prisoner transport train all those 4 miles, but this time in the dark. And the car doors had been left open all those hours, and had lost even their earlier pitiful measure of warmth, and then all the coal had been burned up by the end of the journey, and there was nowhere to get any more now. and in these circumstances they froze all night, and in the morning were given dried carp, and anyone who wanted to drink could shoe snow, and then marched back along the same road again. And this, after all, was an episode with a happy ending. In this case, the camp at least existed. If it couldn't accept them today, it would tomorrow. But it was not at all unusual for the red trains to arrive nowhere, and the end of the journey often marked the opening day of a new camp. They might simply stop somewhere in the taiga under the northern lights and nail to a fir tree a sign reading, First Olp, O-L-P, separate campsite. And there they would chew on dried fish for a week and try to mix their flour with snow. But if a camp had been set up there even 2 weeks earlier, that already spelled comfort. Hot food would have been cooked. And even if there were no bowls, the first and second courses would nonetheless be mixed together in wash basins for six prisoners to eat from at the same time. And this group of six would form a circle. There were no tables or chairs yet. And two of them would hold on to the handles of the wash basin with their left hands and would eat with their right hands, taking turns. Am I repeating myself? No, this was Perabori in 1937, as reported by Losh Chilin. It is not I who am repeating myself, but Gulag. Next, they would assign the newcomers brigade leaders from among the camp veterans, who would quickly teach them to live, to make do, to submit to discipline, and to cheat. And from their very first morning they would march off to work because the chimes of the clock of the great epoch were striking and could not wait. The Soviet Union is not, after all, some Tsarist hard labor akatui for you, where prisoners got 3 days' rest after they arrived. Gradually the economy of the archipelago prospered. New railroad branch lines were built, and soon they were transporting prisoners by train to many places that had been reached only by water not long before. But there are natives of the archipelago still alive who can tell you how they went down the Ishma River in genuine ancient Russian river galleys, 100 to a boat, and the prisoners themselves did the rowing. They can tell you how they travelled in fishing smacks down the northern rivers of Ukhta, Usa, and Pechora to their native camp. Zeks were shipped to Vorkuta in barges, on large barges to Adzbabom, where there was a trans-shipping point for Vorkutlag, and from there only a stone's throw, let's say, to Ust-Usa, on a flat-bottomed barge for 10 days. The whole barge was alive with lice, and the convoy allowed the prisoners to go up on deck one by one and brush the parasites off into the water. The river transports did not proceed directly to their destination either, but were sometimes interrupted to transfer for transshipment, or for portage, or for stretches covered on foot. And they had their own transit prisons in this area, built out of poles or tents, Ust-Usa, Pomozdino, Shishchelya-Yur, where they had their own special system of regulations. They had their own convoy rules, and of course their own special commands, and their own special convoy tricks, and their own special methods of tormenting the Zeks. But it's already clear that it is not our task to describe those particular exotica, so we won't even begin. The northern Dvina, the Ob, and the Yenisei know when they began to haul prisoners in barges during the liquidation of the kulaks. These rivers flowed straight north, and their barges were pot-bellied and capacious, and it was the only way they could cope with the task of carting all this grey mass from living Russia to the dead north. People were thrown into the trough-like holds and lay there in piles or crawled around like crabs in a basket. And high up on the deck, as though atop a cliff, stood guards. Sometimes they transported this mass out in the open without any cover, and sometimes they covered it with a big tarpaulin in order not to look at it or to guard it better, but certainly not to keep off the rain. The journey in such a barge was no longer prisoner transport, but simply death on the instalment plan. Anyway, they gave them hardly anything to eat, then they tossed them out in the tundra, and there they didn't give them anything at all to eat. They just left them there to die, alone with nature. Prisoner transport by barge on the northern Dvina, and on the Vichegda, had not died out even by 1940, That was how A.Y. Olenyev was transported. Prisoners in the hold stood tightly jammed against each other, and not just for a day, either. They urinated in glass jars which were passed from hand to hand and emptied through the porthole, and anything more substantial went right in their pants. Barge transport on the Yenisei came to be a regular and permanent feature for whole decades. In Krasnoyarsk in the 30s, open-sided sheds were built on the bank, and in the cold Siberian winters the prisoners would shiver there for a day or two while they waited for transportation. And V.I. Lenin in 1897 boarded the St. Nicholas in the passenger port like a free person. The Yenisei prisoner transport barges were permanently equipped with dark holds, three decks deep. The only light was what filtered in through the companionway for the ship's ladder. The convoy lived in a little cabin on deck. Sentries kept watch over the exits from the hold and over the river to make sure that no one escaped by swimming. They didn't go down into the hold, no matter what groans and howls for help might come from there, and the prisoners were never taken up on deck for fresh air. In the prisoner transports of 1937 and 1938, and 1944 and 1945, and we can guess it must have been the same in the interval, no medical assistance whatever was provided in the hold. The prisoners lay there, lined up in two rows, one with their heads toward the side of the barge, and the heads of the other row at their feet. The only way to get to the latrine barrels was to walk over them. The latrine barrels were not always emptied in time. Imagine lugging that barrel full of sewage up the steep ship's ladder to the deck. They overflowed, and the contents spilled along the deck and seeped down on those below. And people lay there. They were fed gruel from casks hauled along the deck. The servers were prisoners, too, and there in the eternal darkness, today perhaps there is electricity, by the light of a portable bat kerosene lamp, they ladled out the food. Such a prisoner transport to Dudinka sometimes took a month. Nowadays, of course, they can do it in a week. It sometimes happened that the trip dragged out much longer because of sandbars and other hazards of river travel, and they wouldn't have enough food with them, in which case they just stopped giving out the food for several days at a time. And later on, of course, they never made up for the days they missed. At this point, the alert reader can, without the author's help, add that the thieves were on the upper level inside the hold and closer to the ship's ladder, in other words, to light and air. They had what access they required to the distribution of the bread ration, and if the trip in question was a hard one, they didn't hesitate to whip away the holy crutch. In other words, they took the grey cattle's rations from them. The thieves whiled away the long journey playing cards, and they made their own decks. V. Shalamov tells about this in detail in his Sketches of the Criminal World. They got the stakes for their card games by frisking the suckers, searching everyone lying in a particular section of the barge. For a certain length of time, they won and lost and re-won and re-lost their loot, and then it floated up to the convoy. Yes, the reader has now guessed everything. The thieves had the convoy on the hook. The convoy either kept the stolen things for themselves or sold them at the wharves and brought the thieves something to eat in exchange. And what about resistance? It happened, but only rarely. One case has been preserved. In 1950, on such a barge as I have described, except that it was larger, a sea-going barge en route from Vladivostok to Sakhalin, seven unarmed 58s resisted the thieves, in this case bitches, who numbered about 80 in all, some with knives as usual. These bitches had searched the whole transport back at Vladivostok Transit Point 310, and they had searched it very thoroughly, in no way less efficiently than the jailers. They knew all the hiding places, but no search can ever turn up everything. Aware of this, when they were already in the hold, they treacherously announced, "Whoever has money can buy Makorka." And Misha Grachev got out 3 rubles he had hidden in his quilted jacket, and the bitch Volodka Tatarin shouted at him, "You crowbait, why don't you pay your taxes?" And he rushed in to take it away. But Master Sergeant Pavel, whose last name has not been recorded, pushed him away. Volodka Tatarin aimed a slingshot, a V-fork, at Pavel's eyes, and Pavel knocked him off his feet. Immediately 20 to 30 bitches moved in on him, and around Grachev and Pavel gathered Volodya Shpakov, a former army captain, Sereja Potapov, Volodya Reunov, a former army sergeant, Volodya Trechukin, another former sergeant, and Vasa Kravatskov. And what happened? The whole thing ended after only a few blows had been exchanged. This may have been a matter of the age-old and very real cowardice of the thieves, always concealed behind feigned toughness and devil-may-care insolence, or else the proximity of the guard held them back, this being right beneath the hatchway. Or it may have been that on this trip they were saving themselves from a more important social task, to seize control of the Alexandrovsk transit prison, the one Chekhov described, and a Sakhalin construction project, seizing control of it, of course, not in order to construct, before the honest thieves could. At any rate, they pulled back, restricting themselves to the threat, "On dry land we'll make garbage out of you." The battle never took place, and no one made garbage out of the boys, and at the Alexandrovsk transit point, the bitches met with misfortune. It was already firmly held by the honest thieves. In steamships to the Kolyma, everything was the same as on the barges, except that everything was on a larger scale. Strange as it seems, some of the prisoners sent to the Kolyma in several overage old tubs on the famous expedition led by the icebreaker Krasin in the spring of 1938 are still alive today. On the steamers Druma, Kulu, Nevostroy, Dneprostroy, for which the Krasin was breaking the way through the spring ice, there were also three decks in the cold, dirty holds, and on these decks, in addition, there were two-story bunks made out of poles. It was not completely dark. There were some kerosene lanterns and lamps. The prisoners were allowed up on deck in batches for fresh air and walks. 3,000 to 4,000 prisoners were in each steamer. The voyage took more than a week, and before it was over, all the bread brought aboard in Vladivostok got moldy, and the ration was reduced from 21 to 14 ounces a day. They also gave out fish, and as for drinking water, well, there's no reason to gloat here, because there were temporary difficulties with the water. Here, in contrast to the river transports, there were heavy seas, storms, seasickness. The exhausted, enfeebled people vomited, and didn't have the strength to get up out of their vomit, and all the floors were covered with a nauseating mess. There was one political incident on the voyage. The steamers had to pass through La Pérouse Strait, very close to the Japanese islands. And at that point, the machine guns disappeared from the watchtowers, and the convoy guards changed to civilian clothes, the hatches were battened down, and access to the decks was forbidden. According to the ship's papers, foresightedly prepared back in Vladivostok, they were transporting, God save us, not prisoners, but volunteers for work in the Kolyma. A multitude of Japanese small craft and boats hovered about the ships without suspecting. And on another occasion in 1938, there was an incident involving the Druma. The thieves aboard got out of the hold and into the storage room, plundered it, and set it afire. The ship was very close to Japan when this occurred. Smoke was pouring from it, and the Japanese offered help, but the captain refused to accept it, and even refused to open the hatches. When Japan had been left behind, the corpses of those suffocated by smoke were thrown overboard, and the half-burned, half-spoiled food aboard was sent on to camp as rations for the prisoners. Decades have passed since then, but how many times Soviet citizens have met with misfortune on the world's oceans and in circumstances where it seems that Zeks were not being transported? Yet, because of that same secretiveness disguised as national pride, they have refused help. Let the sharks devour us, so long as we don't have to accept your helping hand. Secretiveness, that is our cancer. Short of Magadan, the ship caravan got caught in the ice, and not even the Krasin could help. It was too early for navigation, but they had been in a hurry to deliver labourers. On May the 2nd, they disembarked the prisoners on the ice, some distance from the shore. The newly arrived prisoners got a look at the cheerless panorama of the Magadan of that time. Dead hillocks, neither trees, nor bushes, nor birds. Just a few wooden houses and the two-story building of Dalstroy. Nonetheless, continuing to play out the farce of correction, In other words, pretending they had brought not simply bones with which to pave the gold-bearing Kolyma, but temporarily isolated Soviet citizens who would yet return to creative life, they were greeted by the Dalstroy Orchestra. The orchestra played marches and waltzes, and the tormented, half-dead people strung along the ice in a grey line, dragging their Moscow belongings with them. And this enormous prisoner transport consisted almost entirely of politicals who had hardly encountered a single thief yet. And carrying on their shoulders other half-dead people, arthritis sufferers, or prisoners without legs. And the legless, too, got prison terms. But here I note that I am again beginning to repeat myself, and this will be boring to write and boring to read, because the reader already knows everything that is going to happen ahead of time. The prisoners would be trucked hundreds of miles and driven dozens of miles more on foot, and on arriving they would occupy new campsites and immediately be sent out to work, and they would eat fish and flour chased down with snow, and sleep in tents. Yes, it was like that. But first the authorities would put them up in Magadan, also in Arctic tents, and would commission them there too. In other words, examine them naked to determine their fitness for labour, from the condition of their buttocks, and all of them would turn out to be fit. In addition, of course, they would be taken to a bath, and in the bath vestibule they would be ordered to leave their leather coats, their Romanov sheepskin coats, their woolen sweaters, their suits of fine wool, their felt cloaks, their leather boots, their felt boots. For, after all, these were no illiterate peasants this time, but the party elite, editors of newspapers, directors of trusts and factories, responsible officials in the provincial party committees, professors of political economy, and, by the beginning of the 30s, all of them understood what good merchandise was. "And who is going to guard them?" the newcomers asked, sceptically. "Oh, come on now, who needs your things?" The bath personnel acted offended. "Go on in and don't worry." And they did go in. And the exit was through a different door, and after passing through it, they received black cotton breeches, field shirts, camp-quilted jackets without pockets, and pigskin shoes. Oh, this was no small thing. This was farewell to your former life, to your titles, your positions, and your arrogance. "Where are our things?" they cried. "Your things you left at home," some chief or other bellowed at them. "In camp, nothing belongs to you. Here in camp we have communism. Forward march, leader." And if it was communism, then what was there for them to object to? That is what they had dedicated their lives to. And there are also prisoner transports in carts and simply on foot. Do you remember in Tolstoy's Resurrection how on a sunny day they drove them on foot from the prison to the railroad station? Well, in Minusinsk, in 1940-something, after the prisoners hadn't been taken into the fresh air for a whole year, they had forgotten how to walk, to breathe, to look at the light. And then they took them out, put them in formation, and drove them the 15 miles to Abakan on foot. About a dozen of them died along the way, and no one is ever going to write a great novel about it, not even one chapter. If you live in a graveyard, you can't weep for everyone. A prisoner transport on foot, that was the grandfather of prisoner transport by rail, of the Stolypin car, and of the red cattle cars, too. In our time it is used less and less, and only where mechanical transportation is still impossible. Thus, in one sector of Lake Ladoga, the prisoners were sent on foot from besieged Leningrad to the red cars, nicknamed Red Cows. They led the women, together with the German POWs, and used bayonets to keep our men away from them so they couldn't take their bread. Those who fell by the wayside were immediately tossed up into a truck, alive or dead, after their shoes were removed. And in the 30s, each day they sent off on foot from the Kotlas transit prison to Ust-Vim, about 185 miles, and sometimes to Chibiu, more than 300 miles, a transport of 100 prisoners. Once, in 1938, they sent off a women's prisoner transport the same way. These transports covered 15 miles a day. The convoy marched along with one or two dogs, and those who fell behind were urged on with gun stocks. True, the prisoners' possessions, as well as the cooking pot and the food, brought up the rear in carts, and this transport thus recalled the classic prisoner transports of the past century. There were also prisoner transport huts, the ruined houses of liquidated kulaks, with windows broken and doors ripped off. The accounting office of the Kotlas Transit Prison had issued provisions to the transport based on a theoretical estimate of the time the journey would take, provided nothing went wrong on the way, without allowing for even one extra day. The basic principle of all our accounting. Whenever delays occurred en route, they had to stretch out the provisions and fed the prisoners a mash of rye flour without salt, and sometimes nothing at all. In this respect, they departed from the classic model. In 1940, Olenyev's prison transport, after disembarking from the barge, was herded on foot through the Taiga from Knyaz Pogost to Chibiu, without anything to eat at all. They drank swamp water and very quickly got dysentery. Some fell by the wayside out of weakness, and the dogs tore the clothes off those who had fallen. In Izhma, they caught fish by using their trousers as nets and ate them alive. And in a certain meadow, they were told, right here is where you are going to build a railroad from Kotlas to Vorkuta. And in other areas of our European north, prisoner transports on foot were standard until the time when, on those same routes and roadbeds built by those earlier Zeks, the jolly red cattle cars rolled along carrying later prisoners. A particular technique for prisoner transports on foot was worked out where such transports were frequent and abundant. When a transport is being taken through the Taiga from Knyaz Pogost to Vesliana, and suddenly some prisoner falls by the wayside and can go no farther, what is to be done with him? Just be reasonable and think about it. What? You aren't going to stop the whole transport, and you aren't going to leave one soldier behind for everyone who falls. There are many prisoners and only a few soldiers, and what does that mean? The soldier stays behind for a little while with the fallen prisoner, and then hurries on to catch up with the rest. Alone. Regular transports on foot from Karabas to Spassk were retained for a long time. It was only 20 to 25 miles, but it had to be covered in one day, with 1,000 prisoners in each transport, many of them very weak. It was expected in cases like these that many would simply either drop in their tracks or else fall behind through the indifference and apathy of dying men. You may shoot at them, but they still can't go on. They are not afraid of death. But what about clubs, the indefatigable beating of the clubs wherever they hit? They are afraid of clubs, and they will keep going. This is a tested method. That's how it works. And so, in these cases, the transport column is surrounded not only by the ordinary chain of machine gunners at a distance of 50 yards, but also by an inner chain of soldiers armed only with clubs. Those who have fallen behind get beaten, as, in fact, Comrade Stalin prophesied. They are beaten again and again, and even when they have no strength at all with which to go farther, they keep going, and many do miraculously get to the destination. They don't know that this is a testing by clubs, and that those who lie down and stay lying down and don't go on despite the clubs are picked up by carts following behind. That's organizational experience for you. And one can ask, why, then, didn't they take them all on carts in the first place? But where could enough carts be found, and horses? After all, we have tractors. What about the price of oats nowadays? Such transports as these were still common in 1948 to 1950. And in the 20s, transport on foot was one of the basic methods. I was a small boy, but I remember very well how they drove them down the streets of Rostov-on-the-Don, without any qualms. And the famous order, "We'll open fire without warning," had a different ring at that time, again, because of a difference in technology. After all, the convoy often had only sabres. They used to deliver orders like this, "One step out of line and the convoy guard will shoot and slash." That had a very powerful sound, shoot and slash. You can imagine them cutting off your head from behind. Yes, and even in February 1936, they drove on foot through Nizhny Novgorod a transport of long-bearded old men from the other side of the Volga, in their homespun coats, and in real lapti, bast sandals, wrapped around with onuchi, Russian peasant footcloths. Old Russia disappearing. And all of a sudden, right across their path, came three automobiles, in one of which rode the chairman of the Central Executive Committee, president of the Soviet Union, this is to say, Kalinin. The prisoner transport halted. Kalinin went on through. He wasn't interested. Shut your eyes, reader. Do you hear the thundering of wheels? Those are the Stolypin cars rolling on and on. Those are the red cows rolling every minute of the day and every day of the year. And you can hear the water gurgling. Those are prisoners' barges moving on and on. And the motors of the Black Marias roar. They are arresting someone all the time, cramming him in somewhere, moving him about. And what is that hum you hear? The overcrowded cells of the transit prisons. And that cry?